Well, good morning, TNC family, from my home to wherever you are. And let me start with this. Reading and studying scripture, which is what these podcasts are devoted to, is one important way we learn to live well in the universe God created, ordered, and sustains. It's a way to develop the courage and wisdom needed to live the good life that Jesus taught and modeled. Even when everything around us can seem chaotic and confusing. And so, our goal here this week and each week is more important than forming the right theology or remembering the right information. It is to learn from these biblical stories of God's movement over the millennia, how we can move with God in our era. It's to connect with the God who is alive and well in our space and in this place. And today I want to consider an ancient story oozing with present-day application, a story that took place in the days when the judges ruled the land, when the nation of Israel was organized into a loose confederation of tribes, not 50 states, but 12 tribes, governed by judges. And judges were more like tribal chieftains than black-robed legal analysts. They were to bring order and protection for the tribes and help the people live in freedom as they together lived in light of the Torah. So what you need to think is, for this story, is that a judge was the supreme political and military authority over all of Israel. And the story that we explore now is told in the book of Judges, chapter 13 and verse 2, where we learn that a certain man named Manoah and his wife have been unable to become pregnant, and so they have no children. The idea is that they're an older couple and they have been trying to have kids for a very long time, for years, about the same time each month. You can imagine that their hopes and their prayers would intensify, only to realize they'd have to wait yet another month. It was an emotional and exhausting experience. But the text says that one day the angel of the Lord appeared to Manoah's wife and said, "Even though you have been unable to have children, you will soon become pregnant and give birth to a son. The waiting is just about over." And then in verse 5, the angel gives more instructions. "But no razor may be used on his head, because the boy is to be a Nazarite, set apart to God from birth, and he will launch the deliverance of Israel from the hands of the Philistines." Set apart. Launch the deliverance. Being a Nazarite would mean he would have special purpose and power. And it would mean taking three vows that would help the Nazarite exercise this power with fairness and gentleness and wisdom. And the three vows are outlined in the fourth book of the Torah, Numbers chapter 6. Here's vow number 1, verse 3. "A Nazarite must abstain from wine and other fermented drink. Further, just to make sure, he must not drink grape juice or eat grapes or raisins. He must not eat anything that comes from the grapevine, not even the seeds or the skins." Vow number 2, verse 5, "No razor may be used on his head. A Nazarite must vow not to cut his hair." Third vow, verse 6, "Throughout the period of his separation to the Lord, a Nazarite must not go near a dead body." More specifically, is that they will not touch a dead body. And in this case of Manoah and his wife's son, verse 7 tells us that God says these are to be lifetime vows from birth until the day of his death. No wine, no haircuts, no dead body. Three practices to help the Nazirite learn to stay away from things that are unwise, drunkenness, unnecessary, a haircut, and unclean, a dead body. And the key, here's the key, it's not that these rules are just arbitrary, it's they are set up to help mold the character of the one in power. Because the more power one has, the more that character is needed. Verse 24, and so the woman gave birth and named him Samson. And he grew, and the Lord blessed him. And he became a man with extraordinary skills, including he was physically strong. And he became the 12th judge of Israel, a person with power and influence. Which leads me to this. Power is a tricky thing. First, because most people like having it. It gives them a sense of control and safety and importance. I remember when I was in fifth grade, I went to a church school in North Carolina, and our teacher, Mrs. Elliott, would occasionally leave the classroom for a few minutes, and she would pick a student to be in charge of the classroom until she got back. And oh, how we all would raise our hands. Me, I want to be chosen to sit in your chair and be in charge until you get back. Because there's this thrill that comes with power. It's why we love Superman and Wonder Woman, Captain Marvel, Captain America, Batman, Black Panther, Spider-Man, the Hulk, Iron Man, even Popeye the Sailor Man, whom we love most after he has the power. I mean, I don't think we'd like Popeye near as much if when somebody hurt him or olive oil, he ate some spinach, contacted the bad guy, met him over coffee, helped him work out his problems, and extended forgiveness and healing. Because there's this thrill that comes with the exercise of power. But power is a tricky thing. Which is why the Greek playwright Euripides said in 400 BC, whom the gods would destroy, they first make drunk with power. Some of you know that over the last 10 years or so, I've spent some time helping couples in pre- and post-marriage counseling. And one of the things that I've come to see in that time is that if you show me an unhealthy marriage, I can likely show you a husband who thinks it is his right to exercise power over his wife, or a wife who plays power games with her husband. I'm saying that beneath the money trouble and the in-law challenges and the communication struggle is a power struggle. And this is true elsewhere too. Show me an unhealthy parent-child relationship, and I'll show you a child who powers up in the way he acts and talks to his parents. Or a parent who regularly lords their power over a child. I'm the parent, you're the child. Show me a corrupt church, and I'll show you a pastor who tries to control church members, or church members who try to manipulate their pastors. Show me a dangerous work environment, and I'll show you a boss who enjoys bossing his or her employees, and employees who either overtly or passively strike back and try to hurt their employers. There are corrupt white people who fear losing their power to minorities, and corrupt minorities who want power only so they can pay back those who've hurt them. There are dishonest politicians who compromise anything to stay in power. And there are dishonest candidates who, in challenging those politicians, use any deception available to seize power from the incumbents. There are corrupt nations that, in order to become world powers, willingly threaten the survival of the human race by building weapons of mass destruction. Do you see it? Whom the gods would destroy, they first make drunk with power. Which gets at the spirit and the motivation behind the Nazirite vow, which is to build character, so that the person with power does not use it in ways that are unwise, unnecessary, or unclean. Because even though power is tricky, we all know it's necessary. Just look at history. Anarchy is the most unstable of all political and social conditions, and always results in new and worse forms of oppression. I'm saying many people come into power to help, the right motivation, but when they get power, helping proves more elusive than they imagined. If you've ever seen The Hunger Games, it makes this point masterfully. This is why the character of our leaders is of supreme importance. I finished reading a few weeks ago Phil Jackson's book, 11 Rings, The Soul of Success. Phil Jackson, of course, is famous in the basketball world for coaching two NBA franchises to a total of 11 world championships. And at one point in the book, there's a chapter called Warrior Spirit. And I thought, before I read the chapter, the warrior spirit. Dominate the court. Crush your opponent. Nope. Do you know what 11-time champion Phil Jackson says that the warrior spirit is all about? He says it's about focusing on the inner life of a player rather than the outward life, and helping each player, each warrior, develop a spirit within them of mutual sacrifice, sharing, and servanthood. Phil, you gotta be kidding. Are you serious? Listen to what he writes. Quote, most coaches get tied up in knots worrying about tactics, but I preferred to focus my attention on whether the players were moving together with the right spirit. Because when the spirit was right, then the game was always likely to unfold in our favor. Now, you can argue with him, but it's hard to argue with 11 championships. Or listen to John Wooden, the great UCLA basketball coach, who won 10 NCAA championships in a 12-year period. Quote, I always taught my players to be more concerned with their character than their reputation. Or listen to the great First Lady, Barbara Bush, in her book, Pearls of Wisdom, Little Pieces of Advice That Will Go a Long Way. Quote, treat everyone equally. Don't look down on anyone. Use your voice for good. The most important yardstick of your success will be... Okay, now what is she going to say? How do you measure whether someone is a winner or not? What's the yardstick for success? This is her answer. Quote, the most important yardstick of success is how you treat other people. Or Michelle Obama, she writes, for me, becoming isn't about arriving somewhere or achieving a certain aim. I see it instead as a forward motion and evolving a way to reach toward a better self. In other words, she says, becoming isn't about an external location. It's about an internal process in maturing. Or in James Charlton's book on war, leadership, courage, and victory, where he quotes the general Norman Schwarzkopf, who led the U.S. Army in the first Gulf War. Quote, leadership is a potent combination of strategy and character. But if you must be without one, be without the strategy. Keep the character. And even Martin Luther King Jr., he understood that better days come when we are judged not by the color of our skin, not by outward metrics, but by the content of our character. So back to our story, because Samson has all these amazing outer skills and he has all this power, but it's like the fine clothes on a mannequin, because there's nothing on the inside. It's like a house of cards, stacked and racked on the outside, but with a fragile foundation. It's like abs of steel, but a character of silly putty. And so Samson comes to power in his 20s, and he falls in love with the privilege of his position, instead of using his position for the privilege of love. And the result is division and conflict among the people, violence in the nation, and weeping, and nobody wins. And I want to now just walk through some episodes in Samson's life where his lack of character makes his exercise of power so destructive. And I want to walk through these episodes because I believe that Samson faces some choices that you and I face, even in our day and in our places of power. That's right, your place of power. Because here's the key for the rest of this teaching. Where is the place of your power? In the home, in the classroom, on the field, at work, in the neighborhood, as a teacher, as a friend, with your checkbook. What about this? Behind the keyboard? A lot of us have power behind the keyboard. And I'm saying that as we walk through this story now, will you apply this teaching to your place of power? Here we go. The first story that we read about Samson after he's become a man and come into power is recorded in chapter 14, beginning in verse 1. The text says that Samson went down to Timnah and saw there a young Philistine woman. When he returned, he said to his father and mother, I have seen a Philistine woman in Timnah. Now, get her for me as my wife. Notice the text just says, he saw her. Not, they met on Match, or eHarmony, or Tinder, or Zoosk, and he reviewed her profile and suspected that they had similar interests and values. So he contacted her, and they shared more ideas over the phone before finally he traveled to Timnah, where they volunteered together, and he got to see her extraordinary mind and her compassion firsthand. Nope. Just, he saw her. He saw, he wanted, and so he went. 'Cause he could, 'cause he had the power. Notice he doesn't even know her name. He comes home and says, I have seen, don't know her name, a woman in Timnah. Doesn't even know her name. Because he's in power and she's just a pawn. And here's our question, friends. In your sphere of power, in your home, at work, neighborhood, behind a keyboard, how are you treating people? As unique individuals, as image bearers of God, as people with opinions and ideas that matter, or as objects to serve and please you, as people to dominate and control? Notice also that Samson sees her and wants her and says, real respectfully, get her for me. He states his desire to his parents as a demand, a sign of horrible disrespect. First, in that culture, parents arranged marriages for their children. Second, children never spoke to parents that way. And I'm just trying now to point out the language of power versus the language of character. I'm saying your language matters, especially when you use it in your place of power. Those in power should not call people names. Dumb or crazy or stupid or little or retarded or a thousand other names. John Meacham, who's a historian, best-selling Pulitzer Prize-winning author, in his book, The Soul of America, The Battle for Our Better Angels, he surveys leadership in American history, and he writes at one point this observation. The moral force of leadership is always more important than the political force. With power, he writes, comes not only legal and administrative responsibility, but also moral and cultural responsibility. Get her for me! Samson says, get her for me! Verse 3, his father and mother replied, is there not an acceptable woman among your relatives or among all our people? Must you go to the pagan Philistines to get a wife? Notice how his folks tiptoe around people, around Samson, the one in power. Notice in general how people tend to tiptoe around people in power when those in power lack character. Because there's this fear of repercussions if they disagree or speak against that person in power. But Samson says, verse 4, get her for me. She's the right one for me. Now, here's another observation. Power without character will lead you to ignore good advice. Which leads to this question. When's the last time you accepted advice in your sphere of power? Changed your own way of thinking because someone called you out. I'm just saying, if no one has changed your opinion or significantly confronted you on anything in the last 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, then maybe it's because you lack the character to respond to feedback, and so nobody wants to cross you. I'm not saying that's for sure what's going on. I'm just saying maybe. Back to Samson, verse 5. One day, Samson went down to Timnah, and as he approached the vineyards of Timnah, suddenly a young lion came roaring toward him. Now, I've heard if it's a bear, you freeze. You don't run. But with a lion, I think it's okay to run. But notice here in the text, and this is something I really admire, a lion roars at Samson, and Samson is like, here, kitty, 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 kitty. Come on, big guy. I got something for you. Verse 6, and he tore the lion apart with his bare hands. But he told neither his father nor his mother what he had done. Verse 7, sometime later, when he went back to marry his fiancée, he turned aside to look at the lion's carcass. In it was a swarm of bees and some honey, which he scooped out with his hands and ate as he went along. When he rejoined his parents, he gave them some honey, and they too ate it. But he did not tell them he had taken the honey from the lion's carcass. Why? Remember his vows, the things that would help mold his character and remind him, I want to be pure, not just with my body, but also with my mind and my heart. He breaks a vow here, touching a dead body. Why? Because he's hungry, and he's got the power, so he can. He saw, he wanted, he took. And at some level, he knew it was wrong. That's why he hid it from his parents. And friends, often when you and I hide something, not always, but often, it's because you care more about power preservation than character formation. Fast forward now to chapter 14. One day, Samson goes down to see his fiance to make wedding preparations. And the text says, verse 10, as his father was making final arrangements for the marriage, Samson threw a party at Timnah, as was the custom for elite young men. And 30 young men from the town came to be Samson's companions. The idea here is like a drinking, wild bachelor party. And now he's broken vow number 2, nothing from the vine, because he has the power, so he can. But at the party, read the text, Samson gets bored, and so he decides to mix in some gambling to liven things up. And he tells the Philistines, I'll make you a bet. I will tell you a riddle, and if you solve it, I will give you each an expensive outfit. But if you can't solve it, then you all have to give me an expensive outfit. Verse 13, tell us your riddle, they said. Let's hear it. Samson replied, out of the eater, something to eat. Out of the strong, something sweet. This is a reference to the lion and the honey. And of course, the Philistines don't know the answer to the riddle, and they have a lot of money at stake. So they go to Samson's fiance. Quote, coax your husband into explaining the riddle for us, or we will burn you and your father's household to death. So Samson's fiance threw herself on him, sobbing, you hate me, Samson. You don't really love me. You've given my people a riddle, but you haven't told me the answer. She cried the whole 7 days of the feast. So on the 7th day, he finally told her because she continued to press him. And she, in turn, explained the riddle to her people. And so the men solve Samson's riddle, and Samson is furious because they used his fiance. Samson said to them, quote, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle. Samson blames his friends and his heifer, the word he uses for his fiance. Oh my. But Samson will pay up and give each of the 30 men a new set of clothes. But watch how. The text says Samson went down to Ashkelon, but instead of going to the local clothing shop, he murdered 30 of their men, stripped them of their clothes, and gave them to those who had explained the riddle. Because those with power, but without character, tend to use anger and violence as a tool to suppress those who challenge them. And by the way, the marriage never happens, because when the bride is threatened with her life and responds by manipulating and lying to the groom, and when you call your bride to be a heifer, and when you kill 30 members of the bridal party, it just doesn't go very well after that. And so a little later, Samson goes down to the valley of Sorek, and he sees another woman. Chapter 16 and verse 4, her name was Delilah, and he falls in love. And the Philistines will now use Delilah to get to Samson, to find out the secret of his strength. And so Delilah keeps asking him, what's the secret? What's the secret? What's the secret? And Samson keeps making up answers. Finally, she says to him, how could you say you love me when you won't confide in me? This is the third time you've made a fool of me and haven't told me the secret of your great strength. Verse 16, with such nagging, she prodded him day after day until he was tired to death. So he told her everything. No razor has ever been used on my head, he said, because I have been a Nazarite, set apart to God since birth. But if my head were shaved, my strength would leave me. And now, because he's hooked up with the wrong partner, and because he never learned to say no, Samson, who has such spectacular skill, shreds the final indication of his dedication to God, and he breaks his last vow. Verse 19, after putting him to sleep on her lap, Delilah called for someone to shave off the 7 braids of his hair, and so began to subdue him. And Samson's strength left him. Do you see what's going on, friends? Because for Samson, his outer strength left him because of his lack of inner character, his inner strength. And one of the things we actually see in this story is that Samson's lack of inner strength will never be made up for by his external power. Which means this is a great time for me to stop and to ask you, will you spend in your life at least as much time on your character development as you do on your skills development? Will you devote yourself to prayer and to small groups and to community and generosity and listening and learning and growing? Will you pray with the Apostle Paul in Ephesians chapter 1 that the eyes of your heart would be enlightened? Because after the Philistines capture Samson, they gouge out Samson's eyes, which ironically will begin to allow Samson to see his insides clearly for the first time. Now, the end of the story. Sometime later, the Philistines are having a party in the temple to one of their gods, Dagon, the grain god, and they bring Samson out of prison to mock him. Verse 25, they shouted, bring out Samson to entertain us. So they called Samson out of prison, and he performed for them. to humiliate him. But then they made their mistake because in their power, they underestimated his. And what they did next was their downfall. Verse 26, they stood him among the pillars. Yep, those things that stabilize the building. And there is Samson feeling the pillars that support the temple. And he's standing there with no sight and no hair. But he calls out to God for help. And the good news is that even at the end of his life, when he's messed up so much, when he's beaten, blind, and broken, when he cries out to God, God hears him. Which is great news, because I think there's at least a little bit of Samson in all of us. And so I think it's really important that we remember today that God doesn't love us because we're skillful. God doesn't love us because we have perfect character. God doesn't love us because we've reached some moral high bar in our lives. God just loves us because he's God. And so you and I can be sure that he's here for us too, in our era. He's here to help us if we want him to, because he's always available. And God, he'll never leave Samson either. Even at the end when Samson calls out to God for help between the pillars, God listens. And Samson prays to God. And even his prayer, honestly, it's a little mixed because part of his prayer is a cry for vengeance. But he prays to God and God says, okay, your strength is coming back. Verse 28, then Samson reached toward the two pillars on which the temple stood, bracing himself against them, his right hand on the one and his left hand on the other. Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. And then he pushed with all his might, and down came the temple on the rulers and all the people in it. It's a story about power and character. And I hope that we will take it to heart today. Let's pray. God, I pray that the eyes of our hearts would be enlightened today for our era, that we might know the hope to which you have called us, the hope of a life filled with your love and your strength and your wisdom and your presence. Amen.